Namaste and welcome to another edition of the Bharatvartha Weekly. I'm Roshan Karyappa. You didn't see me for a couple of weeks, but I'm back. So I have with me Nirav Kanodra and Prasanna Vishwanathan, and we're going to run you through the news and events of the week that was. As always, let's begin with the episode that we put out last week. This was a fascinating conversation. It was really a distinct privilege and honor to talk to Meenakshi Jain ma'am, right? So she's probably, I think, you know, one of the top 10 people in the last 30 years who have kind of shaped the narrative on very important issues, right? Her book on Ayodhya or, Satyavrata and so on and so forth. And here, I think, it was great to talk to her about her journey itself. She spoke about, you know, how difficult it was initially, and how, you know, the Marxist historians had a stranglehold on academia and the general narrative as such, and how she went direct to readers, through her narrative style of writing, and spoke a fair bit about her book as well, Vasudeva Krishna and Mathura. So Vivek, who was co-hosting this with me, had very pointed questions on the book, and excellent discussion overall, and definitely something for the history buffs and enthusiasts to check it out. So, all right, speaking of history, last week history was made. The Kashi corridor was inaugurated by Prime Minister Modi. He reached the temple complex, took a dip in the Ganga River, and addressed a gathering of over 3,000 guests, asking them to make three resolutions: cleanliness, creation, and Atmanirbhar Bharat. The first phase will give pilgrims a smooth 400 meter walk from the ghat to the centuries old Shiva temple. The corridor around the temple is now spread over 5 lakh square feet, up from the earlier 3,000 square feet. After the ceremony, Prime Minister Modi and the UP Chief Minister Yogi Adityanath had lunch with the workers who built the corridor. Prasanna, this was an epic moment, right? Epic moment, I would say.
I would kind of trace the journey from the time Modi, Prime Minister Modi, filed his nomination for the first time in the run-up to the 2014 election, okay? And I think that was such a not only electorally significant in the sense that, you know, he kind of led BJP's political charge in UP from the front, in terms of the election signaling, but it was also a very critical civilizational signaling as such, you know, because Kashi has been epitomizes the Indian civilizational ethos in terms of, you know, the storied past that it has, and to the current challenges that it faces. Actually, you know, the city has been in need of infrastructure upgrade, and, you know, like, it kind of becomes symbiotic of a lot of things that was wrong with the country. On one hand, you know, like, you kind of boast about her great past, but the appalling civic conditions, you know, the filth, the dirt, extremely terrible conditions in which the pilgrims had to offer their prayers in the most holiest Hindu spot. I think, like, it was very convenient for, I think, the earlier idea of India system, right? Like, pay a lip service to the greatness and continuity of the Hindus, but at the same time also shame Hindus that, see, look at your holiest places and how dirty have you maintained. You know, that kind of conveniently, I mean, you could signal to your domestic audience that you are in touch with the Hindu ethos, while, you know, you are also able to, at a global stage, you know, it is very useful to shame India, actually. I think Modi picked a very tough battle and has persisted through this, you know, and I think this is like a enormous effort that goes into doing this entire exercise, and we're just talking only about the phase one. Actually, I think, like, another decade, I'm sure, you know, the kind of infrastructure initiatives that Prime Minister has envisaged for this particular city, I think this is going to be a complete transformation of Kashi. You know, personally, very happy that one of my team members, Harsha Bhatt, has been, you know, in the forefront of chronicling the transformation of Kashi. You know, she's made multiple visits there. She's tracked how this entire project has come through, starting from the land acquisition challenge. And of course, there are a lot of entrenched interests, you know, who quote, who also masquerade as traditionalists and say that this is like a assault on the heritage and all that, which is another major resistance that had to be overcome through very carefully navigating through the challenges. You know, so basically, I think this is an excellent project where the Prime Minister, you know, has most unambiguously used his political capital to signal that, you know, this is a civilizational movement of India that has arrived, and it's up to the people to grab it and take it forward, actually. So within the, I would not say the limitation, within the framework of the democratic polity, I think this is as much as it can get in terms of explicit signaling that India is just not merely a constitutional construct, it is also a civilizational state, actually. So looking forward to the further developments in that Kashi corridor, I'm sure, you know, from cleaning up of the river to the multiple infrastructure projects, there's a ropeway that is going to be launched. So, I mean, lot of things are happening. And I think, of course, UP, this Kashi corridor is a part of a larger infrastructure upgrade that's happening with multitude of expressways. You know, yesterday there was a fifth expressway, which is the longest expressway in UP, which was launched, actually. I mean, and one good thing in terms of how the infrastructure is being developed in UP is that, you know, land acquisitions are completed before the projects are launched, actually. You know, so this, even this Ganga expressway, I think almost 98% of the land acquisition is complete. So, you know, you have to look at it as a whole resurgence, physical and as well as the you know, either Ayodhya temple coming up, Varanasi, you know, even the Buddhist circuit in Pubanchal, which was revived. Very, very inspiring, actually. I hope that the Prime Minister and the government, whichever government comes to power next, chase the course. And I think this is a very critical movement because, you know, this entire Pubanchal and parts of Bihar and all is where, you know, you have a huge concentration of people living, but they've not got the kind of infrastructure, whether physical, medical, social. And so I think this is like a very historic moment where if India can, for the next decade, take its development momentum to these parts, which have never been touched so far, you know, like AIIMS for Gorakhpur, for instance, got a AIIMS very recently, right, actually. So, I mean, it has been the hotspot of so many kids dying over the years without even getting reported in the media and all that. Finally, they got a good tertiary healthcare option. So, you know, like if this is going to happen, I think we'll have roads connected, people connected, markets connected. You know, you'll have a unleashing of tremendous human capital potential, which is going to emerge from that pocket of India, you know, which sadly you can't blame the people there. You know, it's about the lack of opportunities and lack of infrastructure and all. And almost everybody who wanted to have a higher quality of life or standard of living, they almost had to migrate to Delhi, possibly to Mumbai. So, you know, I think this can significantly change the entire region. It'll be very, I think, like a lot of people think the entire thing is just a religious symbolism or a project. But I think if you really look at what is happening in UP, including the Kashi corridor, I think this is where I think somewhere previous prime ministers like Vajpayee and the previous BJP governments in UP missed it out. So here you are packaging both, you know, a religious narrative along with solid welfare delivery and infrastructure development. This is like, I mean, to put it very crudely, Hindutva plus plus, actually. So, you know, let's see how this spans out.
No, I mean, you hit the nail on the head. I think this has so many facets to it, right? I mean, one is the fact that you are respecting the civilizational reality of the country, right? Second, I mean, for anyone who has been to the temple, it's actually a wonder, you know, how so many people would gather around in this holy shrine, do the darshan and then, you know, experience that, right? Because, yeah, I mean, I was there about a couple of years ago and it was, so while I was really, you know, happy to have the darshan and everything while coming out, I was just thinking, man, this is not the grandeur that befits the one of the holiest shrines of our nation, right? I mean, and simply from an economic or, you know, tourism perspective as well. I mean, I've said this, that if you go to the US or Europe, I mean, anything, even a few hundred years old, right? Somebody sat on a bench, I mean, they'll make it a site and there's a whole economy that's spun around it. And here we have things that are thousands of years old, so integral to the country, right? And we don't give it the due respect. So on multiple things, I think, you know, this was a very heartwarming event, I feel. Probably the best moment of the year for me. Actually,
yeah. Adding on, actually, see, one is this whole Kashi complex redevelopment. One, it has a great tourism potential. So one is just domestic religious tourism that you can compare something like what the Hajj gets or what Jerusalem gets, etc. As well as it can actually be like a much bigger portion where you see like people from overseas, foreigners who come visit India. Basically, I don't think Banaras or Kashi was on the map earlier. And this kind of puts it on the map. You will see like how, as you mentioned, people in Europe or US are visiting monuments which are a few hundred years old. And with this temple complex, it puts it on a must visit list kind of a thing, right? So you can get a lot of global tourism. You're going to have better infrastructure, better airports. With this, you have like locals setting up nicer homestays via either Airbnb or other platforms or better hotels, as well as the other lesson you can take out from it is urban renewal or urban infrastructure. You had a lot of houses, a lot of those which were built around the whole complex, right? And now you kind of like acquire that and you made something much bigger, which actually benefits society. You are seeing redevelopment projects happening in other cities like Mumbai, which I'm more familiar with. But the lessons from this can be used for infrastructure projects, for urban renewal, building a better park or better amenities, right? Or a hospital, college, university, etc. And resettlement of the people around, I think there is a really big lesson. And all of this for a cause which is reflecting like our older civilization, as well as enabling people to go to a temple and for their religious sentiments and not face all the inconveniences
Absolutely.
Which was there earlier, right? Yeah. So if you reduce the friction in that, the people who used to visit Kashi only once in their lifetime probably might be, you might see people going there every year, right?
Yeah.
So I think that it's a very big booster for the local economy, tourism, society, etc. So it's a very well executed project, and it has lessons in like scaling similar projects in maybe different areas quite well.
Yeah. No, I hope this is a template for other sites in India for sure, right? Moving on. The Niti Aayog's VK Paul has projected 14 lakh cases per day of the Omicron variant of COVID. As per the central government's data, India has reported 11 cases of Omicron variant so far. However, India recorded a single day rise of 24 fresh cases yesterday. Dr. Paul said, if we look at the scale of the spread in the UK, and if there is a similar outbreak in India, then given our population, we will be at 14 lakh cases every day. ICMR Director General Dr. Balram Bhargav also showed similar concern over Omicron, asking the population to avoid non-essential travel and mass gatherings while observing low-intensity festivities. Nirav, I mean, it seems like a... I mean, what kind of an extrapolation is this, right?
So I think one is, first of all, human mind cannot easily look at like extrapolation of... exponential series, right? It's like, it's a very tough thing. Sometimes it pays to be more conservative and be cautious. That I agree. I probably might not agree with the 14 lakh cases, but I do believe that it is prudent to all those who are not vaccinated to be vaccinated. I hope the government of India has already approved Bharat Biotech's Covaxin for children, but there and Zydus Cadila as well. Probably that has not been rolled out yet. Hopefully there are some measures to roll it out, because one third of our population is below 18. So hopefully all of them do get vaccinated as well. I think in the fighting of the virus, yes, probably being prudent is good. To be fair, even a few thousand cases is too many. And even one death is one death too many, right? So as much as you can avoid sensibly, but you cannot shut the country down, because the economic impact or the side effects of that can be much worse, right? So yes, it pays to be prudent. A lot of these people who are assigned these task forces, say in Niti Aayog, etc., they would like to err on the side of being more conservative, more cautious, right? It's a lot of like these economists and banks who kind of, they say they've successfully forecasted 10 of the last two recessions, right? So always, people are always cautious, a little more prudent. But yes, I think all the other recommendations, right, I think they are to be followed. I do believe we'll see a spike in cases. Omicron has seen that. Thankfully, in South Africa, we've seen a fall after it's hit a peak. I don't know if it is due to lower testing. I am not so sure about the data over there, but it seems to be quite good. They were the first to sequence it, actually, while probably it started in Europe somewhere. So hopefully it's a milder version. We treat it as an endemic disease. Maybe this kind of creates a panic where people rush in to get their second doses or rush in to get their kids vaccinated, reduces vaccine hesitancy. So hopefully, fingers crossed. I think we saw a peak of 4 lakh cases in early May this year, and that was really drastic. I think 14 lakh would be just devastating. I probably think we've reached sort of herd immunity via infections plus vaccination. So this might not be true, but it always is good to remain safe and prudent.
Right. Yeah. So in a nutshell, vaccination, yes. Lockdown, no. Precaution, yes. Panic, no.
Yes, right? Absolutely. You hit the nail on the head.
Right. All right. Moving on. Bhutan has conferred its highest civilian decoration on Prime Minister Modi. The award, known as the Order of the Druk Gyalpo, was given to the PM to celebrate India's close ties with Bhutan. This comes at a time when China is pressuring Bhutan to settle a border deal catalyzed by military presence at the Himalayan country's borders. Prime Minister Modi expressed gratitude towards the King of Bhutan for the honor, saying he was deeply touched by the warm gesture on the occasion of the National Day of Bhutan. Well, even more interesting, controversy has unfolded after the BCCI and Virat Kohli clashed over the T20 captaincy. The BCCI has said that they requested Virat to not step down as the captain for the T20 team after removing him as test captain. Kohli, however, has stated that nobody asked him not to relinquish the T20 captaincy. Reportedly, Sourav Ganguly had personally asked him not to step down as the skipper. He has now ceased to comment on the matter, stating that the BCCI is dealing with the issue. The media has now turned this into the biggest drama since the Kumble versus Kohli debacle in 2018. Nirav, your thoughts?
Okay, so I think there's a lot of people coming out with their own versions and coming out to the media. It tells you that not all is well. Within the BCCI, there's some breakdown in communication between, say, BCCI chief Sourav Ganguly, Virat Kohli, and Rohit Sharma, who has been given earlier he was given the T20 captaincy and now ODI captaincy as well. And you're also seeing there are talks about like Rohit Sharma not traveling for the test series to South Africa, and Virat Kohli probably, earlier there were rumors that he won't be a part of the ODI series, which now coming out in the press conference, he says that he will be a part of it. So I think there's a bit of breakdown in communication. I think personally, I think like captaincy probably comes with a shelf life. Indian team has done quite well, but like sadly, it's not won any ICC tournaments under Virat Kohli. So maybe you need some sort of a fresh thought or a fresh perspective. Virat Kohli is obviously like one of the best batsmen in the world. He's a very talented cricketer, very great cricketer. His inputs to the team would be like valid and important as well as a senior player. But maybe I think you go in one direction, one line too long. You need some sort of change. But the whole thing could have been communicated better. I think everybody should have been on the same page. I think to the outside world, even if there's a transition, there's always someone who's unhappy. And if Sourav Ganguly wanted to, whether he wanted to or no, I think this washing dirty linen in public is kind of giving the cricket team a bad name. Hopefully, the focus moves back to cricket and performances on the field rather than off the field. And in the South Africa series, that's one country where India has never won a test series. So they've been traveling there since like 92. And
oh, we came close, right? I mean, I think...
Yeah, we've come close a couple of times. The last.
I remember Srishant
yes.
having like a dream spell.
Yes, exactly. So we've lost a couple of series. It's been close series. But we've never won a series there. And this whole resurgence of this team actually started from the Johannesburg test, which we won in South Africa. And after that, we've gone and won, beat England in England. We beat Australia in Australia, right? So I think it's time for the Indian team to be united inside and try and beat South Africa in South Africa. I think like how they moved on after the Kumble Kohli controversy. I think hopefully all the team members move on after this controversy and focus on cricket.
Yeah, no, for sure. I mean, I hope the focus gets back to cricket, right? I think there's more politics in sports than in politics these days, right? Yeah. So in other news, the center has decided to raise the legal age of marriageable, the legal age of marriage for women from 18 to 21. The decision is based on the recommendation of a four-member task force led by former Samta Party chief, Ms. Jaya Jaitley. This task force was looking into increasing the age of marriage and its implication on women and child health. The proposed bill may also contain amendments to various personal laws relating to marriage of various communities to ensure a uniform age of marriage. Prasanna, there's been some controversy, I would say, on Twitter about this. I'm not sure, I mean, offline, how people react to this. But would love to know what your thoughts are.
It was based on the recommendation, as you just pointed out, of the Jaitley panel. Personally, you know, I think like this is a good step, establishing parity for the marriageable age between both the genders. And good thing that they're doing in terms of this particular amendment is that I think consequential amendments will be made in the personal law of, Islam, Christianity, Special Marriages Act, everything actually. So, you know, this is also going to be a general, gender neutral kind of an legislative change, which means that this particular change is largely driven by very secular considerations, according to me. Like, you know, basically, I think the entire argument is that it gives that much more time for the girls or the women to upskill, you know, probably have better access to education and, you know, make much more informed decisions on the marriage, which according to me looks very unexceptionable argument. And of course, you will have the more nuanced position that, you know, while this might be a good step, and it's almost that, you know, educated, at least among the educated and probably the economically well-off middle class, almost this 21 is already, you know, even if it's not mandated by the law, it's almost like women get married only after, 21, 22. I think the average age, marriage age in India is around 22.5 or something like that. So, you know, already there is a transformation in the society. But this marks the fact that there are, you know, significant religious groups and economically vulnerable groups where women do get married very young, actually. So, you know, this entire position that state shouldn't be do anything, it's basically education, awareness that will drive to it. I mean, it's a valid argument. And then, of course, there is this extreme libertarian position that, you know, state should not interfere in any such things because, you know, even in Western societies, you don't have any mandated age and all that. I mean, I don't have much sympathy with that kind of position, you know, like especially in a country like India. We do have well-directed state measures that have had beneficial effect on the long term, you know. So that kind of argument doesn't have much appeal to me. The only thing is possibly educate awareness and then legislate. That could be one model that could have been taken. But I think overall, a step in the right direction done based on secular considerations. And I hope that, you know, it does not convert it into a religious issue, actually. Like, but early signals doesn't seem quite encouraging, you know, the kind of inflammatory and, you know, provocative comments coming, especially from some Islamic politicians, some especially from the Samajwadi Party, doesn't seem very encouraging that I think this might be converted into another, they'll say that this particular law, though, despite the fact that, you know, I mean, this is gender, I mean, this is religious neutral amendment. And it's going to be, the one other point is that there have been a lot of courts, right? Though the Child Marriage Prohibition Act explicitly keeps the marriage age as 18 and 21 for the genders currently, which will be now amended to make it in parity. There have been a lot of cases, like, say, people who have married under the laws related to Muslim marriages, 15-year-old girls, 16-year-old girls, I mean, I think like there as soon as you attain puberty, you're eligible to get married. So, you know, the courts have kind of privileged the personal laws over the Child Prohibition Act, which is applicable largely to only the Hindu and the Special Marriage Act. So to that extent, if these things are corrected and you kind of make it 21 across board, I think, I think like 15, 16 year old, I don't know, a lot of people who are in the position of privilege arguing that, you know, this choice should be with the parents seem like quite troubling to me. But anyway, I think this is something that was, I think Prime Minister announced in the Independence Day address that, you know, this marriage age proposal is under consideration. So I think this is it's a good step.
I think one thing is probably, it might be interesting to see the correlation between, you know, economic situation and marriageable age, right? Because my hunch is, I think economically well-off people marry later, right? So, I mean, that's just anecdotally true, right? And
we must have a very honest discussion that, you know, like, especially among Hindus, almost over the years, it has become that, there have been winds of change have blown and, you know, people, of course, Hindu personal laws were touched as early as during the independence, but over the period of time, because it's not very dogmatic and people are amenable to persuasion and robust arguments, I think over the period of time, I think the marriage age is fairly, like you say, you know, is a function, unless it's a very extreme poverty type of a situation or something like that. I don't think so there is any religious consideration driving marriages, early marriage for women, or like say, you know, because the book says that they have to be married or they are eligible to be married once they attain puberty. I think that is not there among at least the 80% Hindu community, I would say, with conviction.
Right. And this is also seen as perhaps a precursor for the Uniform Civil Code, right?
Yeah, you could say that. Actually,
speculation at this point of time.
Yeah, but I think this kind of critically addresses, at least there is a uniformity in terms of the age for the marriage. I think you could argue that but I think it takes much more than all this probably to have the Uniform Civil Code.
I think, just adding a bit, I think two key things what this probably does is it reduces maternal mortality and any complications when it goes like a little bit higher, right, from 18 to 21. And two, this encourages two things, say like at the bottom of the pyramid, like a lot of people feel that like women should be married off as soon as like they're legally allowed. And probably this allows maybe three extra years of education, either through like a diploma course or like a bachelor's degree, probably, maybe in anything. So allows for like more women either to be educated, or like women, instead of just going from like reaching high school, passing high school and then getting married and raising a family, maybe allows women to be a part of the workforce as well.
Correct.
So India severely has like the very, very poor, where women are forced to work, they are the ones who are working, and the very rich and the very educated, they are working. But it has a U-shaped curve for women's participation in the labor force.
Absolutely.
So this could also change. So I think, instead of looking at it in terms of like everything through like a religious angle or everything through a left versus right angle, I think the positive offshoots to society could be drastic. A lot of women, even if they have got like a bachelor's degree, probably helps a long way. Each year of education, additional education goes a long way in not just for them to be able to raise their families a bit better, as well as in future, like earning potential or that sort, right? So in this sense, I think even though like a lot of people are, they are opposing for the sake of opposition to a political party, I think the positive offshoots here would be tremendous.
Tremendous. See, I think like if this is like typical progressive, typically for which something that left would stand for in a conventional political, understanding, right? Like this is like women's empowerment. This is like better health outcomes. There are no arguments about it actually. But I think like I mean, the I don't know whether it's the political polarization or the perversion of the left discourse that I find even feminist and you know, progressive left questioning this move. Of course, you know that they're I mean, they are claiming with all sorts of very silly reasons, but they don't want to acknowledge, and probably they see it as a you know, a step that is probably aimed at one particular community. You know, I mean, of course they can't state it because that also acknowledges that problem in that community. They don't even want to flag it, but they are kind of being very clever by using all kinds of you know, free choice and other type of arguments to oppose what is like probably a very progressive step. You know, so this entire perversion of the discourse is quite tragic, to say the least. That, you know, you can't do a good thing where, you know, people just use it as a
like in the left, like in the US, the left would be actually praising this, and it would be the right which would be criticizing it, right?
Yeah.
So absolutely.
No, I mean, anytime. I'm just fascinated, actually, you know, something which is, which I assume is perhaps common sense. I just notice so many nuances to it when you just look at opinions, right? I mean, that you have never even considered, right? I mean, it's yeah. It's
I saw one Hindu traditionalist arguing that basically the government is doing because they want to make the women workforce available to the multinational companies.
Yeah, I saw that.
What do you call doing those dull, dreary jobs. I mean, it's like, I don't know, it just gets
<It's> absurd.
I think actually, if like more women enter the workforce, you will see like a massive multiplier effect.
Correct.
It is very much beneficial to a society. So maybe I am biased. I grew up with
a person. No. I think it's
pretty, I absolutely believe this.
I think this entire move is driven by the kind of secular outcomes, right? Like a better workforce participation, one for sure, better health outcomes. And, you know, like younger the women giving birth to the kids, you know, the consequential health issues for the mother as well as the kid.
Mother as well as
these kids. Are all the things on which India is shamed on global metrics, yes. Right?
Actually. Yeah.
So I think any government with the heart in the right place would be doing things like that, actually. I mean, and it's also not that like they're not doing other things in terms of improving nutrition, improving maternal health initiatives and all that, you know, like it's almost cast as if you got to do A, you got to do B, and you also got to do C. It doesn't mean that you, just because, I mean, there is one legislation, there is nothing happening on the welfare side, right? It's all a comprehensive package that works in tandem. I mean, I think this commonsensical, what do you call, viewpoint somehow goes missing completely in today's polarizing times.
Absolutely. In some exciting news, Kidambi Srikanth has qualified for the men's singles final of the World Badminton Championship with a win over another Indian, Lakshya Sen. The 28-year-old former world number one will be the first Indian to play the men's single final. Some honorable mentions for this contention are Prakash Padukone in 1983 and Sai Praneeth in 2019, who both lost in the semifinals. In the final, Srikanth will face Singapore's Lo Kian Yu, who defeated Denmark's Anders Antonsen 23-21, 21-14 in the other semi-final. Nirav, will you be watching this closely?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Actually, so this is what we are seeing is Indian badminton has been consistently performing. So we've had in the WBF, the World Badminton Finals, is a marquee year-end event. We've had previous winners as well. So PV Sindhu and Saina Nehwal have reached the finals, right? And PV Sindhu has won it. But this is the first male badminton player to reach the finals. We also had like a very nice young prospect, 20-year-old Lakshya Sen, who reached the semifinals, right? So it's a good thing. We've got a pipeline. This hopefully encourages other sports apart from cricket. Actually watching badminton like for the last few years. So one is living in Singapore, where it is quite popular, as well as with the success of Indians. I think this is a sport which should get a lot more advertising money. It can be wider participation for people. All of Indian advertising money towards sport is like maybe gobbled up by cricket, right? So I think this is a very positive thing. Hopefully, like wishing him all the best today afternoon when the game is, that hopefully he wins it and encourages a lot more people to take up sport. And we also need like different role models. I think the last Olympics was great. We had like a new hero coming up in terms of Neeraj Chopra, but we need this to be spread wider. And my long-term hope, India becomes a sports playing nation instead of just a sports watching nation.
Absolutely. Great way of putting it. And finally, Harnaz Sandhu, a Chandigarh-based model, has won the Miss Universe. She became the third Indian to win the title after Sushmita Sen in 1994 and Lara Dutta in 2000. Following her win, both Sushmita and Lara reached out to her on social media and congratulated her. Okay, Nirav, Prasanna, any thoughts?
So first thing I would like to point out, she's 21-year-old who won the Miss Universe and she's not married yet. So like, you know, this kind of says that make your daughters Miss Universe and beauty queens. So that is one thing. The second thing is, see, I frankly believe all the participants who are there, they're all like give or take equally good looking or beautiful. Whatever, these are like kind of cosmetics companies who look at it and they see wherever the potential for additional sales are. So I would like to say it in 94 and previously even Madhu Sapre is the finest, right? That was just after India's liberalization. I think the year 2000 was just when like the dot-com fear was there, and then like the Indian software companies became big and a lot of outsourcing happened. So in 2021, I think this is more of a reflection of like Indian economy, that it's at a near-term peak. This is why like cosmetics companies feel that there is enough spending power where who will be able to spend money, right? We've had like recent years, maybe Miss Philippines winning when after the oil economy in Venezuela was booming in the 90s, there were a lot of Miss Venezuela's winning Miss Universe and Miss World, right? So I look at it from a very different angle. I think, yes, obviously, just being part of the contingent itself like says that she's a winner, right? So it's a very positive thing. It's a nice thing. And like one my friend pointed out when I like discussed the same thing, he said after 94 and after 2000, right, the following year saw a stock market crash. So let's be cautious. This is the Miss Universe index, right? Like the skyscraper index, the tallest skyscraper being built in a country sees the economy seeing a recession next year. So maybe this is one. So let's be cautious.
Well, let's hope not. And let's hope this bucks the trend. So, yeah, fascinating discussion today. We have, something coming up next week where we're going to do a year-end special. This will be a year-end review sort of a thing. We'll have all of your favorite panelists and talk about politics, policy, culture, all the key things that shaped India today, right? And this is something to look forward to. So, again, thank you so much for joining us this Sunday and look forward to seeing you guys next week again. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Roshan. Wonderful talking to you. Thank you.
Bye. Thanks, Prasanna. Thank you, Nirav.